Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing the conversations about the cultures of consciousness. And this week, there's certainly a major culture out there getting ready as we speak, packing up the gear, buying the lip gloss, the condoms, the bottles of water, the sparkles, the eyeliner, the furry coats, and the nefarious unmentionable compounds. Yes, it is August, and that means it is Burning Man time. And today, I'm very happy we have Steve Jones on the show, a.k.a. Scribe, a longtime journalist, newspaper reporter in California, now editor of the Bay Guardian, and the author of a great book from a couple of years ago, The Tribes of Burning Man. And so we'll be talking about that particular scene. There's so much to say about this event as it increasingly makes a mark on the wider world and develops its own multiple streams of culture, behavior, expectation, lifestyle, music, fashion, all of which have been leaking out more or less intensively over the last, 5 years, noticeably, as the event continues to grow in size and sort of cultural recognition, no less than Grover Norquist is going to be making it this year, so you know it's happening, and perhaps that's a controversy we can chat about, or there are others. And I know Steve's been working on a Burning Man piece recently, presumably for The Guardian, and we can talk about that, so I look forward to that very much. I do want to recommend his book, and in some ways the idea of books about Burning Man is kind of anathema, but then in some ways that's also a bit of the problem with Burning Man, but maybe we'll get to that. Steve's book is probably my favorite. I mean, there's a couple of really good things out there, but what I like about his book, which is subtitled How an Experimental City in the Desert is Shaping the New American Counterculture, is that while he tells lots of some background to the event, he really picks it up where he's most involved in the sort of 2000s, around 2004 forward, showing how the event is changing his own personal relations. But he's also a great reporter, so he's able to go out and represent and give voice to all these different currents of scenes. And he makes the point that Burning Man is not a culture, a counterculture even. It is a sort of matrix or a city, really, where all these different varieties of subcultures can find and make themselves. And so you really have to take kind of a broader view rather than just talking about Burning Man as if it's one kind of thing. Really, what has it been used for? What things have come out of it? What are the different zones that have been established? How are those changing, et cetera, et cetera? So I look forward to this conversation very much. Before we get to that, bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Good morning, Maja. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Eric. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a bright and sunny day. I'm also down here in Los Angeles, where you abide, and it's a toasty day.
It's hot,
but it's not going to be as hot as it is in Burning Man. You know, I was going to go to Burning Man this year, and then a variety of things, including my own laziness and unwillingness to take on too much stress without a good payback, prevented me from doing so. So I'm actually kind of relaxed right now as I enjoy the sun. I'm going, oh, well, I don't have to face that fierce, monstrous sun for a week, which is, I guess, maybe a little bit of a too lazy an admission. I'm supposed to be a razzle-dazzle countercultural figure here, and I'm sorry.
Well, I tend to err on the grandma side myself as well. I'm really disappointing, I think, for people that think my life is scandalous or party style, so I'm right there with you.
Well, we were saying, maybe there's a whole new kind of theme going here, which is being post-party.
Right. It's true.
I don't like to think that I'm post-party, but in some ways I'm kind of post-party. And not that Burning Man is just a party,
yeah,
but it's partly a party.
I'm good at a party for like an hour, and that's about it.
Right, but you do have something to say about the whole notion of gathering in a yearly way to go to an ecstatic revelry that requires a great deal of work and sacrifice to get there. I mean, this is a very, very old trope in human culture. What does that make you think of?
It's a pilgrimage. I mean, I would see if you kind of back up from any theme or interpretation of purpose, it's on a large scale is a bunch of people having a pilgrimage to an ideal or an experience, much like in so many of the ancient cultures and especially esoteric and occult cultures, right? That whole idea of the ordeal to even get to the place, which were usually on a mountain, in a desert, right, in caves. They were usually at locations similar to that. In almost every religious pilgrimage, going to the desert is a big thing.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, and you also have to, what it reminds you as well when you think about these older rituals is that whatever you might say about the event in general, about the people who put it on, about how it's organized, that you really can't talk about it unless you look at what happens to individual people as they go there and they experience their own transformation. So sometimes it's easy to look at an event from the outside and be like, it's kind of a cult, it's kind of lame, it's a big da da da. But you got to acknowledge that there are thousands of people who are going out there for whom it's incredibly important thing in their lives and their personal growth and their own experiences. So it's always hard to generalize when you have that inside sort of transformative dimension going on.
Oh, and you can just see it as energy too, right? Like anytime you get that many people all focused or concentrating on a single thing, that's undeniably going to generate energy, like going to a rock concert or, you know, going to some sacred site. There's going to be, and even just in that place for how many people have already been there, like it's accumulating this sort of energetic, you know, signature on the land from just so many people going to that spot.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, with that in mind, let's bring on Steve Jones, a.k.a. Scribe, speaking to us from the offices of the Bay Guardian. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Eric. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so listen,
good to meet you.
I want to talk about Burning Man and stuff, but first I want to get a little bit more about you. I mean, I've been following your career as long as I've been in the Bay Area. I've been reading your stuff. And, you know, you've been working at newspaper journalism, alternative journalism for a long time, city editor of the Bay Guardian for a decade. I'm kind of curious about how coming from that politically engaged, you know, journalism, reporting, how that kind of led to your interest in Burning Man. Was it something that you went out there personally for? Did you see it as part of your sort of overall project as a as someone covering California in a political way?
Yeah, I mean, I think I did come at it as a political journalist. You know, I was someone who had some interest in the event. I'd been before. I started going in 2001. But it was really at the end of 2004 when there was this big local standoff here in San Francisco that became known as the Borg 2 standoff, where there was a number of big figures from the event, Chicken John, Jim Mason, a whole bunch of artists had signed a petition that they ran in our newspaper saying that we want more of the money going to art, more of a focus on the art. They felt like the sort of party had subsumed the art part and that it had strayed from its roots. You know, I, as a political journalist, just saw it as great sort of existential conflict at the heart of the event. And, you know, and I think the context was important, too, because that was 2004. It was right after President Bush was reelected. So we were in this sort of political dark ages as a country. So I think I saw the real potential in this, you know, experiment in urbanism and community. And I thought it had real potential, and the conflict was interesting itself with lots of colorful characters. So I set off doing a series of articles that then really started to snowball, because around 2005 was when the event really reengaged with the world more. That was when the art started to come back on display in San Francisco. That was, you know, that fall was when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans during the event and led a whole bunch of burners to go down afterwards and set up an encampment and do hurricane cleanup for the next 9 months.
Let's talk about that moment a little bit, because, I mean, for me, that was one of the more interesting. I mean, a nice thing about your book is that you spend a lot of attention on some of the larger, let's say, political dimensions and conflicts within mm-hmm. the event, and there's a number of really fascinating ones that happen during that period. And for me, Katrina is of course one of the more remarkable. I mean, I was there that year, and one thing that's sort of that people have to kind of grok is that news of the event was filtering back while people were on the playa, and it took on very intense proportions. You know, for some people it took on a kind of apocalyptic sensibility. If it wasn't that extreme, then it was also a sense that some kind of, you know, real karma was coming down. And also something that Burning Man, because it was happening at that time, because it was a kind of synchronicity, had to be responded to in kind. And that response, you know, whatever the particular details, although overall it seemed like Burners Without Borders and the response to Katrina was a remarkable thing, it really became a sight of how this event could do something more than just be a party or even just be an art event, that it could go out and have direct social force, that there were particular learning sets, skills, intentions, a lack of bureaucracy, a DIY attitude that could have distinct political effects. So it's a very interesting discussion. I would like to hear you, because these issues are so important to your work, riff on a little bit about, okay, we saw that moment there. What's happened with that legacy? Where have you seen that aspect, whether it's just groups inspired by Burning Man or the organization itself or other regional burns, sort of taking that? What are the challenges with kind of building on that momentum that came out of Katrina in 2005?
Well, I mean, you know, I think when that happened, there were a number of people in the Burning Man community that were anxious for it to evolve and become something else. And I mean, I think that's, you know, wow, it's such a dynamic event and it's different every year because it's built by those who go. The actual structure of the event is a lot of people think is fairly calcified, right? It doesn't evolve, and I think people saw that as an opportunity for it to evolve. You know, saw okay, we've shown that our skills are applicable off of the real world. We were in a country that is hungry for some kind of new ethos, this new sense of empowerment, something that comes from our communities. And so I think there was a real sort of hunger for that. And in being in regular conversation, you know, with founder Larry Harvey all through those years, you know, I think he was anxious for it to have that sort of greater sociopolitical relevance as well. And, you know, and so I think a lot of my book and the reporting I did on the event over those 5 years that led to the book saw it going in that direction, saw the potential there. And I think in many ways the event sort of broke my heart a little bit, because I think it sort of chose not to evolve in that direction. It chose instead to become a bigger and bigger party.
And I agree with you, and I want to stay on this issue because I think that's really important. Now, it's always hard to talk about this stuff with all subcultures because, you know, you get involved at a certain earlier phase, you have your own enthusiasm, and then there's the problem of jadedness, there's the problem of seeing reality of how things actually work versus how they could be, blah, blah, blah. And particularly, again, with Burning Man, because there's so many different people and there's so many different kinds of experiences there. And yet I have the same feeling you do. I have the sense of calcification, of a kind of too much on the party. And what, you know, however amazing parties can be. But the question I have is that, do you think that this is more a result of conscious decisions that were made by the organization, other leading players in the scene, you know, major camps, et cetera, et cetera? Or was it in a way just sort of overwhelmed by its own kind of success at making an amazing party, that like as if there's sort of, it's a more anarchic environment beyond a certain level of infrastructure, and that it just, it's just the power of the party won more because that's what people wanted or that's what people were bringing. How much of it was a kind of intentional or a missed opportunity that could have been done consciously and sort of with an intervention to push it in a new direction?
I think it's a combination, you know, and I think that the organization itself didn't want the event to evolve. They didn't want to give control over the event back to their communities to have greater community buy-in, which I think could have helped that evolution. It's ironic that for an event that derives its value entirely from the volunteer efforts of the tens of thousands of people who go, that it's still a very top-down structured event as far as, like, how many people are going to go, you know, whether it's how it's going to evolve to deal with the increasing number of people, with all the problems that causes as far as just, you know, people getting there and back. I think that, you know, it's, you know, I don't want to discount also what you were saying earlier, that it's still a very powerful transformative event for a lot of those who go, you know, particularly when you're going to your first one or your second one. And I think that I think it is chosen to kind of be that rather than evolve into something else. And, you know, and that's probably a legitimate choice. I mean, I, as someone who think that the values that it espouses are important, and I think it should try to live up to those values and project those values. After a while, it seems as if it's sort of almost deceptive, not living up to its values. For example, you know, decommodification, you know, like we're not going to commodify this. We're not going to monetize it. This is an experience that is going to be free of money. And that's like, great. It's one of the most powerful things about going to Burning Man is being on vacation for a week and not spending any money. You know, you spend a lot of money preparing for it and going there. But yeah, so you decommodify, you know, but then the brands itself have become so valuable. And the Burning Man organization has even created a special limited liability corporation that they called Decommodification LLC that owns all the brands and trademarks. So it's almost like a right?
Well, it's really funny. It reminds me of Buddha, you know, who's very much like, just forget all this. And then all the Buddhists that just sell all these gold statues of Buddha. It's like that's what Burning Man right. is turning into.
No, it is. I mean, as a historian of religion guy who like really is just fascinated with how religions happen, is that without saying, you know, making any determination of whether or not it's a cult, I don't think it's a cult. It's too chaotic to be a cult. There's too many ways to be ironic and sarcastic and, you know, free within the structure for it to be a cult. But it does have a certain kind of a religious thing, and one of the ideas that you find a lot in the people talking about the development of religions is that there's an early period that's very intense. People are having powerful experiences. They're not found on the normal map. There's a lot of charisma, either around particular individuals, but also the event itself. The experience itself has a charisma that everybody participates in. And then over time, things congeal, and charisma, this is a kind of classic account, becomes routinized or bureaucratized, so that the bureaucracy, the structure, the institution, the repetition kind of takes on the management of the charisma, but of course in doing so, it changes it, and to some degree it commodifies it. It turns it into in a modern sense, you'd say, it turns it into a brand. Of course, you know, what they would say about this, the trademarks, is that if they don't do that, then of course all these other actors in the world can come and make their own move, so that in a way it also safeguards some concept about what this brand means against people who might try to use it for, you know, even more crass and against the grain purposes. But in a way, that's part of it. I mean, it's just like the whole, you know, it's a reflection of just the whole crazy scenario, you know. And and one of the things this raises for me is this, is that there is a kind of desire to find a new crack in it, to sort of like have something not work, have something break down, have some kind of conflict that causes the system itself to have to, you know, regenerate on some level, like pranking it on some major scale. And one of the course events that you talk about that's very complicated, lots of elements, lots of moving parts, and one that raises a lot of feelings was, of course, the famous early burn by Addis. And you were covering that. You were talking to him. I was also sort of on the periphery of some of that stuff. I was there and the whole thing, and I was talking to people, and not as a journalist, but I mean, it was something that was really fascinating to me, you know. Mm-hmm. And just to sort of remind people again, it was Monday night, so, you know, days before the official burn, there was a lunar eclipse, and so there was a very weird kind of like 1970s sci-fi paperback moon hanging in the sky, this kind of orange, weird, hallucinogenic orb. And
more people there on a Monday night than had ever been there for that reason, you know, because everybody came early because they wanted to be there for the lunar eclipse. So
Very good point. So there was a sense of something like an older pattern reasserting itself, an older reason to kind of gather. And then, we're out in the outer playa and some driving around on a fire truck, which was actually kind of amusing given what happened. So we're on this, like, unlicensed fire truck, and then there's like, whoa, what's that in the distance? Wait, am I hallucinating? No, we're not hallucinating. And, you know, and we just took off towards this thing, and all these people came. And, you know, I just have to be honest, you know, with whatever politics follow, whatever argumentation, whatever position people take, my experience at that moment was unadulterated glee and a sense of fresh, naive, idiot, innocent exuberance that reminded me of being on the playa in the 90s. You know, and it was like, oh, my God, it's that old school feel where, like, actual chaos has erupted onto the scene and we don't know what's going to happen. And I realized that it's the meaning of that whole event is more than just my experience or that element of chaos. But I thought you know, in your coverage at the time and the way you talk about it in the book, you do a really good job at sort of showing that whole thing. So I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the way you set up that story was really good, because I do think like that is sort of this like fly in the ointment. It is this opportunity for Burning Man to be, you know, off script, to like, what are they going to do now? And this thing happened, and, you know, Burning Man talks a lot about its community and a lot about, you know, and obviously it's such a community-based organization, but like, I think in the wake of that, nobody felt a sense that the community was going to decide how to respond to this. You know, it was more or less, those, you know, in the, you know, Larry and those in the sort of central course, they just ordered another man built. You know, they ordered the wood, ordered another man built. You know, and I think it just struck a lot of people as, like, you know, it was good or it was bad or it was whatever, and certainly everyone was talking about it that year. I mean, why not have some kind of town hall meeting on the playa? Why not have some kind of, like, really sort of authentic exercise in community? And part of it is because, you know, and I've spoken with Larry Harvey a lot about this over the years, you know, he doesn't like democracy. And he doesn't want, like he thinks it's really messy, you know, because, like, he doesn't want democratic structures to be part of Burning Man. He thinks it's easier if he and those around him are just sort of in charge, you know. And then, You know, and they will argue that, you know, there's a democratic character to everything that comes because people decide what to bring and all that. But that's not really, I mean, you know, it's the old thing, like, you know, democracy is messy and horrible, but it beats the alternatives, right? And I think there was an opportunity there for, you know, to at least, you know, even if they already knew what they were going to do, like, go through the motions of hearing people out. You know, I'm from San Francisco. We're very big on political process and making sure people feel heard. And even when the fix is in at City Hall and you know what's going to happen, you know, at least we're going to have the, like, hours-long hearing where everybody's going to bitch and moan and shout and feel like they're able, like their voice matters and that it is some kind of exercise in community. And that didn't happen there. And I think that was a pivotal moment in the Burning Man evolution. That was a moment when, you know, it could have gone one direction or it could have gone another. And it chose to go... It chose to sort of stay the course and just sort of, like, pretend this didn't happen, treat it as a crime, you know, talk about, oh, my God, people's lives were endangered, you know, as if, you know, half the stuff that happens at Burning Man isn't dangerous to some people. I mean, people are hurt and killed there every year, right? Now, this was risky, yeah, but, like, sort of in the ethos and pantheon of Burning Man risks, you know, it was, you know, not really... You know, he wasn't really in danger of people's lives. He probably didn't deserve a 4-year prison sentence, which is what he got. So,
yeah, no, it's a remarkable that whole element and just the sense of I mean, it was a fascinating political moment. For me, it was also the point at which I just kind of went, oh, okay, this is the way they're going. Great.
Yeah.
That's the line was crossed or whatever. The opportunity for some, as you say, even a performance of a different kind of response.
And a couple of moments like that recently. I mean, there was that one, and then there was the moment that occurred as my book was coming out, really, when they decided to, as they said, convert it to a nonprofit, like turn it over from an LLC to a nonprofit. And that was sort of it's not really what happened. It was a deception. You know, it's still as top down as it ever was, even if they've sort of pretended that it's been turned into a nonprofit, you know, because they turned it over to a nonprofit with a hand-selected board based on who could make the money. They all have fealty to the organization. In fact, there's this new book that came out about Burning Man that's actually written by one of the board members. And last year there was a film that came out that the producer was one of the board members. So there's these sort of, like, hagiographic, you know, really what's striking a lot of people as sort of traditional sort of corporate behavior, you know, and not
propaganda.
What I would expect from an organization that espouses the values that it does and has these principles that really go against that sort of way of organizing society.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really, really great point. And there's some other stuff. I want to talk a little bit more about that, the politics of the event in general. But we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Minds, Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Steve Jones, editor of Bay Guardian and author of Tribes of Burning Man. And we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're talking with Eric Davis and Steve Jones about the politics of Burning Man. So if we kind of look at this generally, what we've been talking about, essentially a bunch of people tried to set up an event that existed outside of the paradigms of regular political, diplomatic structure, and then established a thing, and then it turned into this other thing, and then they went into the paradigm they were trying to fight against in order to establish it within the already existing paradigm, and then from there it kind of crumbled into this great big party. So what's interesting is since it did choose to go in the party direction, like we've been talking about, like the implications, something you mentioned earlier about just looking at like what effect that has on the actual people who are participating, kind of like even though it is top down and people are making these choices, what do you, I'm curious, Steve, to know what you think about, like, because there is just like the participants seem to be an important part of Burning Man. Like, they're all volunteering, right. They're all making it, like, they're creating it. So, in a sense, if we do have this structure that's imposing this kind of party theme, and then there are like a lot more party people going, what, like, effect does that have on the artist philosophical participants? Is there like a revolution that will occur within it, do you think? Or will everyone just kind of secede to the party direction, even without the ability for them to complain? Does that mean like everyone's just going to kind of go with it? Or is there going to be like a civil war in Burning Man?
Well, it does appear to be most people just going with it.
Correct.
You know, there are some little dissident factions that have built it, but like you say, like most people who go don't know who the hell Larry Harvey is. They have no idea how the event is run. They don't really care, you know.
Yeah.
You know, their immediate experience is with their communities back where they live, who they decide to go to the event with, you know, and they've heard about the event. They got friends talk about it. You know, it's this libertine place where you can run around with no clothes and do drugs and there's great art and oh my God, did you hear that my favorite DJ is going to be there this year? And, you know, it's for the average person going, that's it. You know, those who then begin to engage on a deeper level, who are struck by it, by the experience of this experimental city, you know, even they will get involved and start volunteering, but they'll be in their little area, you know, and dealing with, you know, like maybe they want to work gate, so they'll be dealing with gate volunteers, and most people really, like as long as it happens every year, they don't really care about the structure of how it's being run. I mean, you know, I'm a political journalist. I care more about these things. I'm from San Francisco. That sort of corporate accountability and process is important to me. Hypocrisy bugs me. You know, if you're going to state certain values, you know, I want you to live according to those values.
Well, it's pretty crazy just because, I mean, with Burning Man, they do espouse like a kind of, you know, a loose philosophy on things. So the hypocrisy is definitely a situation involved there, no matter what you think about the entire situation. I mean, don't you think?
Well, and it isn't even a loose philosophy anymore. Now it's just clearly defined 10 principles, you know?
Right.
And they, you know, in the last few years, they've begun to sort of assert those more, you know, they're like...
Getting kind of propaganda, like George Orwell.
On the front of the visitor guide.
Right. It's getting kind of propaganda style, like George Orwell-y, where it's like they're telling everybody what to do, but then doing totally opposite things.
Yeah, it's a little weird in that way, you know. You know, and I mentioned earlier that Decommodification LLC controls the commodities that are Burning Man, you know. So I think that like a lot of people, you know, who begin to go for several years and learn more about this and feel its potential and are disappointed. I think people tend to sort of after a few years fall away, or those who continue to go year after year. You know, they're more vaguely libertarian, or they're focused on the art, or they don't care that much about the event, you know, as this experiment in urbanism and community. It's just this kind of cool thing to go do.
I want to ask you about this structure thing, because I think you've laid it out very well, and it's always an interesting question. How do we judge the value of a political situation for those people who go? They have politics with their camp. They have politics with like maybe they're a greeter or they're a Black Rock Ranger, and they have to make certain decisions, and there's collective problems and processes. So it's still the case that if people go and get involved, and go a number of years, there's still this kind of process of engaging collective decision-making, resources. Right. You know, there's still a very interesting thing that can happen to people, and yet there is this sort of larger structural question. And you know, I really like the way you phrase it. So you're a political journalist, you're interested in these structural problems, you think that way, you look at the world through those issues, and yet that's a very minority position, and probably,
oh, yeah.
I don't know, increasingly so. Increasingly
oh.
It is a minority
very
position.
Very much so, and I found that out a few years ago when I began shouting about the sort of misrepresentations and how the conversion to the nonprofit would happen, and the fact that Larry frankly admitted that they were going to be that the six board members were going to be giving themselves large secret payouts that they weren't going to disclose. Now I hear that, I'm like, you're kidding me, right? Like, you know, and even talking about how when they're going to a nonprofit, like. They're dealing with corporate consultants, and they're saying, okay, so Burning Man is valued at $26 million because that's what the ticket sales are every year, so we divide that by six, and so each, you know, board member's got that much. I'm like listening to that going, what are you talking about? Like if people stopped going, it would have no equity because all of its equity comes from the yeah. volunteer efforts of those who go. So how do you six claim the value of that? And
you know,
but they do, and they end up making all the important decisions. For example, you know, a couple of years ago, they decided because they're buttoned up against, you know, population issues to increase the population cap to 70,000. Now that's a big decision, and those who went last year saw at times and places on the playa where it was kind of a shit show. I think I could say that. This podcast.
Yeah.
it felt, you felt this larger population. And maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. But again, for an event that claims to be a community-based event, maybe we should have all been able to weigh in on that. Because there were other options, you know. You could have done
Was there a correspondence between them upping the allowance of people in there and it going in the party direction? Did those both happen, like, at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean those happened at the same time. And there's a number of things that went into that. So it's become much easier to just go to Burning Man because there are these plug-and-play camps that the organization has encouraged. That is basically old burners have now made a business of creating a camp for wealthy people who want to just come and show up and have the RVs there for them, have their bike all decorated for them, you know, drug stash in the glove box, whatever, you know. And it's now, and to a lot of people who have been going for a long time, that notion is very counter to the central ethos of this sort of duocracy, where yeah. it is Burning Man has always been based, and the whole reason I chose the tribes of Burning Man for the title of my book is because camps, tribes, that seem to be the sort of essential building block of the city, that like you get with your people, you decide not just how to provide for your own needs, but what you're going to give to the whole city. And that, replicated over and over and over, is what Black Rock City is, right? So it's like the city itself is a very bottom-up community, but it's on this canvas within this structure and heading in a direction that they have no buy-in on. They have no say over, like, where it goes. And even the discussion of what to do with the value of the event denied, you know, people that have been going for decades. And then even once they changed the nonprofit, like they could have created a board that was representative of the various groups and factions of Burning Man. You know, you have a representative of the sound camps, have a representative of the big art projects, have a representative for the volunteer organizations, maybe regional representatives. You know, you could have done a lot of things to have, you know, a board that would have, you know, there would be a representative body of the larger Burning Man community. It chose
yeah.
not to be that. It chose people for their fundraising ability, you know, and well, for their fealty to the leaders. So
one thing you brought up that I think is also really important to emphasize, and that it might even be a little harder to figure out the meaning of it, but I do think it is significant, is that along with the plug-and-play camp, I mean, you mentioned, so you if you have money, you can just, you know, kind of buy your way into it. But that is a little bit, it's deeper than that, in the sense that Burning Man over the last, you know, let's say 5 years plus, has become a major destination for the elite, for serious elite, for serious money, for serious beautiful people, for the models, for the wayward sons of the 1%. I mean, it's, and daughters. It's a very interesting warp, and it's something that I think that's happening in a way across a lot of different fields that we would associate with, let's call it the counterculture or countercultures. It's in ayahuasca. It's in yoga. There's this weird sense that
it's eyes wide shut.
that like major money is getting freaky now. And that part of what you see in Burning Man is this weird zone where these guys get to play. They get to play on some level on the same playing field with everybody else. But, of course, on another level, it totally changes it. It totally distorts it, especially from the perspective of a lot of the salt of the earth burners who have been going for a long time. A lot of them don't go anymore, but who came out of a very, very different socioeconomic perspective, almost polar opposite except for the racial profile. And and it's a really weird thing. It goes beyond Burning Man. So does this resonate with some of your perspective?
For sure. You mentioned earlier that Grover Norquist is going this year, you know, this conservative firebrand who was actually invited personally by Larry Harvey to come. And when he announced he was going, he did it in a tweet saying, yes, I'm going to Burning Man this year, checking that off of my bucket list. And the notion that Burning Man has become sort of one more bucket list thing to do, like going to Machu Picchu or, you know, going to visit India or whatever it is, that there's these things that particularly those who have money and who sort of want to have led full lives and, you know, buy a little enlightenment, it's become this sort of thing to do. And rather than insisting on this sort of we need you to participate, because the whole experiment is based on everyone participating and offering something, they've instead chose to go for bigger numbers, make it more accessible to more people, which like isn't necessarily the wrong decision. But it's a decision that in an organization that claims to be something else and to be very community-based should have had broader buy-in or broader discussion for that kind of
decision.
Well,
and that's where it gets super 1984-y to me, is because it was, if I'm not mistaken, Burning Man was really set up around autonomy and self-authority and, like, the individual. And like you said, Eric, and also you, Stephen, is that, you know, when people would go, it was about, like, DIY or make your stuff, make your bike. And then it's so weird that now these camps where rich people go and pay are set up by the people that came and like did it themselves, and now they're like doing it for other people. It's like a weird guru relationship or something, where like it's like, I did this myself and now I'll do it for you, so you don't do it, but you just do what I do or did.
Right, and it changes the character of the event, you know, where if you can do that, you know, Burning Man as party becomes stronger, and then it just becomes this sort of exercise in hedonism more than something that seemed to have more power and potential.
Well, it's funny, and I can relate it to comics. I was a big zinester, and, you know, Comic-Con, you could argue and watch go the same way as Burning Man. Originally, the comic convention, of course, was set up by a bunch of nerds that were just nerds that made comics. And then they were like, oh, my God, a bunch of people are here. So it got taken over by corporations and all these movies that had nothing to do with comics. And then it turned into a big party and people selling stuff. So it was a little similar, where these little groups of people who have some kind of thing they're going to try to get together, somehow when the word gets, I don't know, what is, it's like some, like, Lord of the Flies degeneration where it reaches that capacity for these things that are cool.
And it's based, I mean, that concept is based on this word that isn't even a word, because every time I write it in my stories, my spell checker doesn't like it, commodification, right?
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
Burning Man's been talking about commodification from the beginning. Like, that was always what it was supposed to be about, is we're not going to commodify the culture. We're not going to make it so you're buying an experience. You're going to come create the experience with those around you. That's always been very central to its ethos. It's always been very central to its rhetoric. But now you can look at that, and it seems kind of silly because it really is they have not just sort of commodified their own culture in order to grow the event to a larger audience and make it more mainstream, you know, but they, you know, are still, you know, sounding as if that's what it's about. You mentioned sort of Orwellian earlier. It seems a little Orwellian. It's sort of like, you know, like they're saying it, but it's sort of like the War is Peace, Freedom is Slavery thing a little bit.
Another side of it is also the whole relationship to, let's call it libertarianism, you know, that from the beginning, this was not an act of progressive left-wing politics. It was a space of much less organization. So a lot of the folks involved early on were much more anarchistic, with even sort of quote-unquote conservative libertarian leanings, not in the sense of being socially conservative, but in relationship to ideas of the state, et cetera, et cetera. And there's always been that element in the counterculture that I think people, we don't really know what to deal with. We don't really have a good model for it. Even going back to the 60s, you think about the left-wing student movements, the SDS, and then you had these hippies that were sort of unorganized, but they had their own sort of political community ideas. But there was also always a very strong radical freedom, like libertarian element to the counterculture, to the whole idea of libertinism. And so when I've looked at, like, the politics of Burning Man and how it's gone back and forth between these kind of, it's like there's a communitarian rhetoric about community and coming together, but then if you actually look at it, there's a little bit more of a kind of corporate libertarian perspective. And so the fact that Norquist is going there, you know, it's not Jerry Falwell or whatever. I mean, it's a libertarian guy who's going to go there. And, you know, one of the great chroniclers of the event, Brian Doherty, is a libertarian and has very strong reasons for seeing Burning Man in a current of libertarianism, rather than in some of the more progressive, collective, state-oriented, interventionist kinds of perspectives. And so sometimes I just think that that's also part of what's going on, is that there are different kind of countercultural models of politics that are getting played out, and the one that has managed to make it is the one that, like the corporate libertarianism that runs, you know, the internet and the ecology of Facebook and the ecology of Google. It's the idea of setting up a structure within which people are allowed to go and play and produce value essentially for free and have a good time and trust that the structure is being taken care of, and not having it be messed up with too much democratic squabbling and arguing about structural issues. No, just stay and enjoy and build it up within your little space, and everything's going to work out. I mean, it's kind of a weird similarity there, isn't there?
Yeah, it is. And I like Brian, and I think Brian's the Burning Man book was excellent, you know.
But he does
come from a libertarian perspective. He does focus on that side, and there is a way of looking at the event. So I've got a quote here from Norquist when he told the National Journal about going to Burning Man. I just love this. Quote: "There's no government that organizes this. That's what happens when nobody tells you what to do. You just figure it out. So Burning Man is a refutation of the argument that the state has a place in nature." Okay. This is an event that is held on public lands, accessed by public roads and infrastructure. There's a lot that goes into this to make an event of 70,000 people. You know, this isn't some kind of spontaneous happening. Part of what the Burning Man organization has done well is work with government. You know, they've always known that, like, you know, they're doing this on public lands. They need, you know, to have public sector support to make this happen. So Norquist, you know, had this idea that this is just this sort of spontaneous, anarchic, you know, libertarian ideal is kind of silly, even though I think you're right, Eric, that sort of duality to the event has always existed, that, like, it's both sort of communitarian and libertine, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know how you rectify that, but I think what Burning Man has always done is sort of do the event for what it is and try to not define it too much. You know, even the 10 principles it cites are really fairly vague and open to lots of different interpretations.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's fair. You know, we've got up just about 5 minutes here, and we haven't talked too much about the effect of the event sort of in the world beyond the event. And obviously we could talk about bands and the transformation of festival culture and the increasing presence of art and kind of spectacular altered states, the rise of psychedelia or re-rise of psychedelia. You know, there's a lot of things to talk about it. But I'm curious from you, when you look at the effects the event is happening outside, whether it's culture or politics or rhetoric or whatever, what do you see that's the most interesting, the most exciting for you, the one that you'd like to see more of, or just even the one that interests you the most?
Well, you know, I think it fills a void. I think right now, particularly for a lot of the young people, they don't believe in the state. They don't believe in corporations. They don't go to church anymore. There is no sort of public institutions that they can be a part of, that feel authentic, that feel like vehicles for them to sort of discover their higher and better self and the role they're going to play in society. So I think for a lot of people, Burning Man is that, you know, both what they do off in the desert for the week and then what it makes them want to do back in their communities with, you know, finding forms of creative expression, finding new forms of community. I think that even though I like I said, Burning Man broke my heart a little bit in I think straying from its potential and becoming a little calcified, I think that central thing that it's always been, it still is, which is sort of this blank canvas on which you can project you know, your own sort of higher vision of yourself and your community.
I agree with you, and that's why I always, whenever I talk about Burning Man, I always preface it with a whole long thing about you always have to remember it's a transformative effects on individuals, particularly people who are young. It's almost like a rite of passage.
And I'm trying to remember that right now because, like, I'm working on a piece for The Guardian that's going to be our cover story for next week about basically Burning Man jumping the shark. And I'm really, as I'm writing this, trying to kind of keep coming back to that idea. But, like, no, but it still has value for the individual. You know, there is still power in the experiment, even if it isn't what it could or should be.
Hey, sounds like the internet to me, man. I mean, you can't talk about the internet now without some serious political problems and problems of group mind, of organ. I mean, there's a lot of really rotten stuff going on, and yet, obviously, it's at the same time, this, you know, wonderful place of data and communication and conversation that we rely on. I mean, it's a different analogy, obviously, but there is something about the weirdness of our moment, politically, culturally, where the problem is absolutely intermeshed with the potential for hope and change. You know, it's like there's two sides of something are increasingly inextricable. I mean, maybe that's just me talking, but it's...
Well, and I'll just add as a final note that a lot of these ideas, for those that are interested in history and that are geeks and nerds, are talked about in Thomas More's book of utopias. A lot of these issues have been around a long time, so it's true.
Fascinating.
Interesting, yeah.
Well, I think we're gonna finish it off there. So, Steve, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
And if anyone wants to read what I write about this, if you're in San Francisco, grab The Guardian. If you're not, go to sfbg.com, and you can read what I have to say about this next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday. Okay, I look forward to that piece very much, man. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
All right. All right, for me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.